ebook publisher and marketing service company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents. Get behind me. Now, stay there. Your favorite fun-filled, informative art and entertainment podcast. Available on iTunes, PRX, Podbean, and right here locally in the great Pacific Northwest on KSKQ 89.5 FM Ashland, Oregon. Art and entertainment news and views that you want to know. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audio Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our wonderful book rental program, Fantastic Books for People on the Go. That's downpour.com.
On this episode, author Nicholas Stanton talks about his new audiobook production, The Gumshoe Diaries, with Jerry Renfro. We ask rapper Thrax Up how his day is going, and he starts dropping bombs. And The Revenant, now a major motion picture, in our downpour.com special feature right after the news you want to know.
We're going to your place, and now you got to freak me out. Scream so loud, getting fucking laid. You want me to stay, but I got to make my way.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Carson Bench.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. The music world has taken a big hit this year. We lost David Bowie and Glenn Frey of the Eagles. And Graham Nash recently gave an interview. He was playing his new album, The Path Tonight. It's coming out in the future here. So Nash was just kind of talking about his experiences with both of the artists. And it was very poignant, I thought. He was talking about how, you know, he knew he knew Glenn Frey pretty well. They grew up not too far apart. They lived on the same Hawaiian island for like 30 years or something like that. And he really called him, you know, the backbone of the Eagles. And Bowie, he said, was a little bit different. But he referred to Bowie as having genius qualities. And I was very struck by that because I remember using a very similar phrase not too long ago. Charlie and I were just discussing, you know, Bowie dropped his new album, you know, what, about a month, I think, before he passed away? And
2 days.
How many?
Just two days.
Oh, wow. Shows my sense of time. So 2 days before he passed away. And I didn't get a chance to listen to it before he passed away. And I kind of wish I had, because after knowing that he knew his time was short and then listening to it and seeing the video, haunting, absolutely haunting. And I just thought, I hope nobody else dies for the rest of the year, because that's too big of a hit already. And
it's sad for all of us, you know, to lose the, you know, icons that we've all admired their work, you know, especially when they've been, you know, around for so long, you know, become like a staple, you know, like you think they're going to always be there.
Well, someone else to include in the the deaths of celebrities is Maurice White, one of the founding members of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Well, yeah, not only Murray's wife, he just died, and the drummer from Mötley Crüe, he just died, and Lemmy from Motorhead died.
And two members of Jefferson Starship, the woman who started White, I think was her last name. She was the first singer they had, and their guitarist, both.
Yeah,
Paul Cantor, exactly.
Paul Cantor died, and then the first original vocalist they had, she died. They died on the same day.
Yeah, I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, but they didn't know each other, I mean, you know, since then.
Right, yeah.
She did the first album, and they decided to replace her with Grace Slick, which was probably, I don't know who made the decision, but that was
the that guy deserves
I,
the medal, yeah.
I think you know why that caught. I think you get that comment, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and when Grace Slick brought, she wrote her own songs. Yeah. So she wrote White Rabbit and all this stuff, yeah. You know, and all the ones that made them famous, you know.
Somebody to Love.
Somebody, yeah, Don't You Want Somebody to Love. You
know, I have those both on my iPad. iPhone.
But you know, I want to say something about David Bowie or David Jones, which was his real name. You know, I'm sure everyone's heard the story, but he changed his name to David Bowie because at the time when he was coming out in the 60s.
Davy Jones, the Monkees.
Yeah, there was already a famous Davy
Jones. Who I've met, by the way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And he, you know, so he changed his name, right? But what I want to say about Bowie is this. You know, a lot of people are... You know, playing his music and making tributes, and they, you know, and justifiably so. And it's hard to pick out all these songs from David Bowie because he had so many great ones over the years. You go like, I forgot about that. Yeah, that was, I love that song, you know, or Let's Dance, or, you know, or China Girl, or whatever. Everyone's got a little favorite, you know. I know a lot of people like that Life on Mars, you know. They do. I love that song, too. I loved it. I bought it. I remember when it first came out. It was on the album Hunky Dory. But anyway, the thing I want to say is, like, you know, we're sad that he passed. And, you know, he was a real true artist right until the end. He didn't tell anybody about his disease except for his family and a couple people in his inner circle. You know, even the producer of the album said he didn't know. Until he got the call from Bowie's wife that he had died or that he was even sick. He goes, I just know he kept getting real frail, but David has a history of doing a lot of drugs and disappearing for for years at a time. Right?
Well, that's one of the reasons he went to Germany for the late 70s. He and Robert Fripp wanted to get out of the whole L.A. party music scene. And he did three albums out there that were heavily influenced by I guess what you'd call krautrock.
Yeah, you know, he talked about that, you know, because, of course, after he died, there's a lot of interviews that people posted up, and he had talked about his time in Germany, and he said he liked it there, and he goes, I recorded three really, you know, big albums for me, you know, Low and Heroes and Golden Years, and, you know, he just said that, he goes, but I really couldn't tell you, to be honest with you, what happened or what day it was or what happened. And the guy goes, is it true you stay up 4, 6, 7 days in a row? And he goes, yeah, that's true.
Crazy.
And he goes, why? And he goes, I have no idea. I can't tell you that. You know,
such creativity. You know,
yeah, they say that line between genius and insanity.
Right. Yeah. And he just said, he goes, that's when I was doing a lot of drugs. And, you know, and he goes, and I don't do drugs anymore. And people still have that image of me as a drug addict, Major Tom.
Yeah.
He goes, and I've been married for over 30 years, grown children, and I don't do drugs. You know,
he's not sleeping with Mick Jagger anymore.
Not sleeping with Mick Jagger anymore.
Well, Carson and
but they're still dancing in the streets.
Oh, my gosh. Now, that has to be a low point. I get embarrassed when I watch that.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. I saw his son, Duncan Jones, being interviewed, right? And he was being interviewed with Mick Jagger's son, Lucas. And they're talking about his father's death, you know, and how they were really good friends. And then so Jagger's son says... Yeah, he goes, you know what? He goes, you know, I saw the video dancing in the streets. Somebody posted it up, right? He goes, I forgot all about that. He goes, but it's so 80s, you know, when you see it. And then he said, you know, he goes, I'll tell you what, you know, he goes, anytime Duncan and I want to have a good laugh, we just put on that video and watch our old men standing up there dancing and kissing with each other and going, this guy, every guy. You know,
it just cracks us up. Atrocious video.
Yeah, there's such a wide range of styles that David Bowie had. And something that I really enjoyed doing was featuring David Bowie on my Maya's Mix show. And that same day, Carson, on Latitude 42, you did a tribute as well. So I think KSKQ was celebrating that day, David Bowie Day. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. You know, and it brings me to that point about his sense of humor. A lot of people don't realize that David Bowie had a fantastic sense of humor. My brother sent me a video that was a collage of all these different, you know, shows he's been on where he was just, like, you know, funny. Like, you know, an example was he was on Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon says, you know, or I forget who it was, Jimmy Fallon, but one of those guys at late night. And they asked him, you know, would I make a public service message or something like that? Some spinoff because he says something about drugs, right? And he goes, you want me to make a public announcement about something? And he goes, yeah, it might be beneficial to all the kids out there. And he goes, well, I'll tell you a public announcement, you know? And he gets this real dark look on his face. And he goes, you know, everywhere I go, I get this question all the time. And I don't mind telling you one bit at all that it's very annoying and irritating. Everywhere I go, everybody wants to know, what's it like being married to a supermodel? And then he goes, looks down and he shakes his head in disgust. And then he looks up with a big smile on his face and he goes, it's great. But in the spirit of his humor, Ricky Gervais has a show in England, and it's a comedy show, and they don't show it here in America. But he asked Bowie a month before he died, they were neighbors, if he would come on the show. Bowie agreed to come on. And so he went on and did a little scene in a lounge. We'll set it up for you. Where Gervais is trying to tell him about his show. And he's with his entourage of girls, and they want to meet David Bowie. And Bowie's trying to be gracious, but he has no interest in what he's saying. So he starts writing a song about it. You know, he's just going, hey, man, chubby little fat man.
It was very funny.
The lyrics were a little sharp.
Kind of poking a lot of fun at Ricky Gervais.
Right. Yeah. So let's hear a little bit of that right now for our listeners so they can enjoy that.
I think I've sold out, to be honest, but yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, to keep the integrity when you're going for that first...
Little fat man who sold his soul. Little fat man who sold his dream. Chubby little loser. Pathetic little fat man, no one's bloody laughing. The clown that no one laughs at, they all just wish he'd die. Fatso takes his own life, he blows his stupid brains out.
But the twat I'd probably miss.
Yes, Linda, I like that.
Yeah, so do I. It's brilliant, Linda.
He sold his soul for a shot at fame. Catchphrase and wig and the jokes are lame. He's got no style, he's got no grace. He's banal and facile, he's a fat waste of space. See his pop, no space. Pop, 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 pop again. See his pop, no space.
Now, Bowie's album, the one that he released 2 days before he passed away, was called Black Star. I know the Grammys are coming up. Is it nominated? It can't be, right? Because it's from the, isn't it from the last year? How does that work?
No, it can't be nominated for this year because
so it would be for next year.
It would be nominated for next year because he released it on his birthday, January 8th, and then he died on January 10th.
Right. I have a feeling it's definitely going to be recognized next year, nominated.
Well, I believe it's his first number one album. Of all the albums he put out, he never had an album that hit number one.
Right.
And so the timing of that is probably going to, put that into the number one category. Bowie wanted to be in The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
He wanted to be Elrond. And Peter Jackson didn't go for that. Of course, we know he was in Labyrinth, but have you guys ever seen the movie The Man Who Fell to Earth?
Yes, I saw it at a movie theater, at a drive-in theater. That's how long ago
that was. That's how long ago. But he is a tremendous actor. He was perfect for that character. It's kind of a sad, depressing movie, though.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? He is a good actor, and some of the things I've seen him in have been ridiculous, and some of them he was really good. If you want to see him at his best acting skills, where he's not a music star, you don't recognize him for any of that, you can watch it on Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, wherever. It's called Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And he plays a Englishman who was taken captive by the Japanese during World War II.
Yeah.
I remember that.
No, it is, and the movie is fantastic, whether he was in it or not, but he does an excellent job. You would never even know that he was in the rock business.
Yeah, he had some serious acting chops, no doubt about it.
Well, most of his music videos and stuff like that were all, like short
except for
little
Dancing
movies.
In the Street. He's like, yeah, I lost money. He lost money. Well, you know, speaking of movies, and one of my favorite times of year in the movie business is Sundance is coming up here. Anybody know anything about what's going on at Sundance this year? I've heard a few things.
There's a lot of things going on at Sundance, and the Sundance Film Festival is, you know, going on. You know, and by the time this airs, it will be over with. What's going on there is, you know, people go there to explore for all different reasons. You know, they consider it's like a movie mecca by countless and countless filmmakers. Like, you know, they all go there and submit, you know. I remember when Sundance first started, you know, it was like maybe there was, you know, one or two, maybe three films at most, right? And it's grown. Now it's just like, you know, the place to be seen. Whether you're in the music business or you're in a movie business or whatever, Leah Dern's there, Matt Damien's there. You know, they, all these people, they show up to this festival, and we've had some people on the show that have been there, like Amara Kopakova, and performed and things like that. It's just a lot of fun. It's a 10-day festival of nothing but, hey, let's hang out with movie stars and rock stars and country stars and people that are all up and coming into business. My little commentary on this would be that I think that the Sundance Film Festival was great when it first started, you know, and I actually went there.
But, you went there?
Yeah.
Did you have fun?
I did have fun, but it was like when it first started, it wasn't a circus. It wasn't like, you know, hey, you know.
Now it's part of the institution.
Now, you know, it's like our independent film festival is still small enough to be an independent film festival where you can actually see some great movies and meet the, you know, the people that made them.
Yeah, because they do Q&As after the films with the filmmakers, and that would be really good.
Yeah. Sundance used to be this really far out groovy place, man, where everything was happening. It was really heavy, dude. But but then it grew, and now it's like independent artists, right? The whole idea was to showcase independent artists, give them a venue where they wouldn't normally be seen. You don't have to be, you know, Ben Affleck or Matt Damien, you know, to be noticed, right? Mm-hmm. And they are not independent film festival anymore.
It's not the underground.
They are mainstream as mainstream can be.
Establishment as it can get.
But then again, you know, they've earned it. They've done it for the last 30 years. I think in the beginning it was a great idea and it worked, you know, like for the first 10 years. But then, you know, as it got bigger and bigger and more, you know, in popularity, like a Lollapalooza or something like that.
Or a Burning Man. That's what it reminds me of.
Or like a Burning Man, right. Yeah. I mean, at some point it just gets too big and you lose focus of what it was originally there.
I sure hope that doesn't happen to the Ashland Independent Film Festival.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing with the Ashland Film Festival. You know, they do a great job, and, you know, it's always good movies, and we have a town that's very artistic, so they appreciate it a lot, and a lot of people try to get into it.
And it's a great administration of volunteers and
staff. Oh, it's a great thing of volunteers and stuff like that. The reason Sundance got so big is because they had money and Robert Redford backing everything they did.
Victims of their own success.
You know,
so
it's like
they weren't going to run out of money, and they didn't need star power. He was one of the biggest movie stars in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get to go have your picture taken with him, and he's going to watch your movie and tell you if it's any good.
Yeah. Well, I would still be interested in going to Sundance to test it for myself.
I will answer
your question, Charlie, if you send me there and pay for the trip for me to go check it out.
Okay. All right. Well, you're going to have to wait till next year because, you know, it's only 10 days.
Good point.
Take some snow boots with you when you go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Designer ones so I can fit in.
It's in Park City.
And take your selfie stick, too.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Because you want to get every picture, man. You know, every movie star you see, you're like, hey, come here quick.
Yeah.
It does make me think, though, when, you know, a scene then becomes the establishment, where do the artists go after that? I mean, they're going someplace. There's going to be another scene.
It's an endless cycle.
Well, no, I'll tell you what. My opinion is on that is that, you know, the movie industry, you know, with the independents now, I mean, you know, people now, big name stars do independent films. And it's not like a big deal to them anymore. It's not a stigma that, you know, you're in a second-class film. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of films are independent.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a matter of getting the backing and things like that. But I think where it's going to go, to answer your question, is that, you know, it's just like with the smartphone. You know, 10 years ago, none of us could imagine that all the school girls and school boys would be running around with smartphones in their pockets.
Yeah.
But they do, right? And right now, everyone's going to these film festivals, and they're doing this. I think what you're going to find is the next wave that's going to hit is the new cool hip cats like Carson Bench are going to be recording in virtual reality, and they're going to be played at special festivals where you can watch them in virtual reality.
Yeah.
and that's your new new frontier.
So that's your prediction.
Dude, you can.
It's going that way. This is going.
I'm telling you. I would, you know, if I was a rich guy, I would bet you right now, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm not a rich guy. I mean, Carson, if I had your money, I'd throw mine away. You know. I just think that's where it's going. It's going virtual reality, and it's going to go where people are like going to have festivals where, like, you know, it's nothing but the new, you know, technology.
Yeah. And if it ends up going over like the internet, then you would have you could have a festival that people aren't even physically in the same place. Well, you know, where you log in if you have your own VR helmet and you get to do everything from right where you are.
Well, I mean, that's, certainly can see that happening. It's already happening in the music world, in concerts. Yeah. There's a lot of video conference.
Right. You know, yeah. Maya and I were talking about that the other day. Mm-hmm. She was watching a video conference series that they aired them at a certain time and people could log in and watch them and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah. The whole thing is going digital, man. It's not just movies and stuff like that. You're going to see a lot of colleges and stuff like that, they're just going to close down because they don't have funding, and it's a lot cheaper to do online. And believe it or not, you get a lot more out of the class online than you do in person.
I agree.
Because you get you get more FaceTime.
Opinion. There's a lot you can get.
Each people get. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on your learning style.
Yeah,
and also the institution.
Yeah, it depends on, you know. I mean, we know we are all used to going to you know, standardized schools. You know, elementary school, high school, college, stuff like that. But I think this new generation, you know. Almost everything is offered online, you know, and you could do more one-on-one time with a teacher online than you can by raising your hand in class, you know? I mean, again, depending on where you live, too. I mean, you know, when you take a class online, there might be 30 people online with you at the same time, right? You know?
I guess I'm just a devoted liberal arts college
well, they do liberal arts
graduate
online.
That feels, yeah, traditionalist.
Let me give a simpler example. Like YouTube videos, right? When they make you how to make ceramics and make this and make that and stuff like that. It doesn't take, you don't have to learn.
You don't have
that.
To have a crystal ball, are you saying?
No, you didn't have to actually go to physically make it. You could get the idea off the line. I'm thinking it's an improvement. And that's where I think that the new movies will go. They'll go with the virtual reality, and they'll go with the, you know, all new technology that they have, because one, it'll be, you know, like blow your mind, technically cool. Two, it's a lot cheaper to use.
Well,
you can film a movie. You can film a whole movie with your iPhone. Now.
Yeah, people have done it.
Now, people have done it. We did a story on this guy. I don't know if you remember him or not, but he was from Detroit, and he was a big guy in South Africa. What's his name? Rodriguez. Searching for Sugarman. And it won the Academy Award for Best Picture of the Year. The entire movie was filmed on an iPhone. Yeah. I didn't know that, and I was talking to my cousin Andrew Stanton, and I was like, hey, man, you know, we want to make this film thing. Is there anything you can do to help me out on this? And then he was going to tell me, he goes, look, you know, did you watch Finding Sugarman? And I go, yeah. He goes, the whole thing was shot on an iPhone.
That's how Sean Nipper does his...
Yeah, and he goes, you know, if you want to make a movie, he goes, just shoot everything on your iPhone and just send me all the footage, man. He goes, and I'll just give it to people at Pixar and they'll mix it together.
You know? Well, not everybody
it's nice
has
to have those
that.
Resources.
Yeah, exactly.
There are some artistic projects out there in all forms that definitely carry through time. One of those, I would say, is Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
So the last Harry Potter book was released in 2007, and the last movie... was at the end of 2010, so new Potter material has definitely been in short supply. But sales of the 7-book series nearly doubled last year in the United States. You want to know why?
I am curious.
Aren't you curious? Well, it's because last summer, author J.K. Rowling announced to her fans that she was back at work, and she was collaborating with the British playwright Jack Thorne on a new stage drama that would be carrying the adventures of the childhood trio into adulthood.
Oh, cool.
So it's actually going to be opening in London this summer. So when this was announced, the result was not just an explosion of interest on social media, but also a revival of sales of the original series. It went up 63% from the year before, if you can imagine that.
No, you know what? I can't imagine it, because that's what my daughters asked for. They wanted the Harry Potter book series for Christmas.
Oh, so they expressed interest. Well, the thing that another aspect that I thought was really interesting, part of the craze has been that Rowling released a new Harry Potter coloring book that offers a sneak preview of the characters. Because I don't know if you guys know, but there's a craze on the market for adult coloring books.
Yeah.
It's huge right now.
You know, it's part of the mindfulness kind of movement. It's the latest global cultural phenomenon. And so because of this Harry Potter coloring book, it has appealed to basically three distinct age groups, I would say. Those who grew up with the books, those who grew up reading the books to their children, and then the current children who are just now experiencing the books for the first time. And so all three of these groups can really, they can enjoy the coloring books for various reasons. So it's interesting that that ends up being
You know what, Maya, that is such a cool story. Because it was weird because, like, you know, for Christmas, I asked one of my daughters, Sarah, says, you know, I go, you know, give me your list for Christmas. And she goes, I want a Harry Potter book. And I go, which one? And she goes, all of them. And I said, all of them? And she goes, yeah, they have a set now. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously.
And she's 12 years old, so, you know, it's a whole
it's
new
generation. It's new to her, totally new to her.
Yeah.
Okay, something that I've gotten a real kick out of is that J.K. Rowling has 6 million followers on Twitter. She has had some really funny tweets because she has a saucy attitude. She had a response to a heckler. She says, the internet doesn't just offer opportunities for misogynist abuse, you know. Penis enlargers can also be bought discreetly. She just has this like sharp edge. There's another one. The Baptist Church. They tweeted that they were having two of the characters. They were saying if it happens, if they marry two male characters, if they marry, we're gonna pick it. And her response was, alas, the sheer awesomeness of such a union in such a place would blow your tiny, bigoted minds out of your thick, sloping skulls. So I just get a kick out of her sharp wit in her social media forum because so many people love it.
It's a rare art form because, you know, we've all met people that are really super quick, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you're just blown away because you're just like, dang, I wish I would have said that. You know, I'm going to write that down, you know? But the thing with J.K. Rowling, what I'm thinking is that she, like a lot of people, I always say this, you know, to my kids and stuff, I always tell them, play your strengths, right? And her strength is writing Harry Potter. That's what she does best.
Yep.
And the whole world loves it and embraces it, right? We did 3 books of hers that she wrote under pseudonyms and did not sell at all.
In terms of the audiobook?
Audiobook or a printed book, because we do print books too now.
Yeah, they were like murder mysteries, I think.
No, they were like, one was called Casual Vacancy.
Oh, yeah.
And then one was a detective story. She tried 3 different genres, and she used 3 different pseudonyms, you know. But the only reason they sold, is, you know, we sold
when
as many as we
found
did,
out.
Was because people knew it was J.K. Rowling that was writing it.
Right.
Because it says right there, you know. But I think that she said, you know what? Everybody still has a huge demand for it. I love doing it. I do it really well. Let's try it again, see what the response is. And that's your art and entertainment news.
Keep listening for Downpour's special feature. Remember Nicholas Stanton from our first show. He's always writing in Southern California, and he talks with Jerry Renfro about his new audiobook production, The Gumshoe Diaries, in this interview.
Hi, I'm Jerry Renfro with Get Behind Me Now, Stay There, and we have with us today, my first time interviewing him, Mr. Nick Stanton, author of a book I just finished and absolutely adored, The Gumshoe Diaries. Mr. Stanton, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. So I just finished the book. I listened to the audiobook version. That's where I get a lot of my books. And I must say, it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. The twists and the turns of the book. I'm so concerned about giving away spoilers. So I was hoping, would you tell the listeners about your book?
Sure. It's a Raymond Chandler-like detective story. With, you know, some humor inserted into it. I do use a lot of twists and turns, as you said. and quirky characters, and a main character in Whitey Rude that sort of out of phase with the times. He sort of fancied himself in the 40s, but he lives in modern times, so occasionally he's sort of out of kilter with the rest of the world.
That really threw me in the very beginning, because I was expecting, like a Phil Hartman-esque, 1940s, private dick. And then when I figured out that it was in the modern age, I was really like, it took a little time to kind of adjust to that. And it made it that much more interesting to me, because you're right. It's like this guy who's thinks like he's, in a detective novel, but living in the modern era. It was great.
Yeah, he has an interesting backstory, having been a former, detective of the LAPD, and was invited to retire early for various reasons, starting with his wife deciding to change teams, and she winds up being, one of his poker playing buddies, and she had already made this change over and was dating someone that he had his eyes on.
Yeah, I really found that the interpersonal dynamics in this were very good. From a personal perspective, I saw a lot of people I know in my life in these characters. These just felt like real characters, because I know people like this.
Yeah, I think everybody can relate to somebody in the book. There's a lot of quirky characters, like I said in the beginning, people that you see every day, and people that you think don't exist, but there they are.
Hiding in plain sight. So I really enjoyed this book, and I see that you are working on a sequel. Can you tell me some about it?
Sure. The Gumshoe Diaries is meant to be a series, and the first installment was Fortune Cookies Always Lie, which is what you read. And I'm currently working on Father Hollyweird, which is another nice twist and turn that I'm enjoying in the LA area. It's basically a story that goes with an activist priest that uses the film as a medium, and the story kind of revolves around that.
And that's another great thing I really enjoyed about it. It felt a lot like a serial. It really did. And that it seems to be a lost art form. There's so many, Dickens, of course, wrote in serial form, and a lot of great authors did that. And I really felt that with your book, and I could totally see it within the series. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I had such a good time reading this one. If you're listening to the audiobook, it was only about, I think it was about 6.5 hours. It's a great rental, a great buy.
Oh, I was majorly pleased with the production from Blackstone.
Yeah, they did a fantastic job. And the voice casting, the voice casting can make or break a book. I mean, you can have the greatest book, but if you don't get the right voices in there, and I always enjoy Bronson Pinchot. I loved his work on TV, but he has blossomed as a narrator, that's for certain, in my opinion.
He brought that character to life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I saw you did some videos too, like serialized videos of the book. Yeah,
my own, like a book trailer, basically.
There you go.
When I got my first advance, for my first book, I took some of that and started a small production company. So we went around Hollywood and too poor to hire an actor for it. So I kind of played the role myself for the Whitey role. But we covered a lot of ground and put together a small trailer. There's three trailers that came out. The first one, I think, is the best. But
I saw one.
Check it out. You can see it on the blog. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the one, your first meeting with Dr. Looney was the one that I watched. I didn't get a chance to see those. Now, that would be Pugnacious Productions. Is that your production company?
Yeah, Pugnacious. Yeah. The first one, check that one out. That one really set up the book really well.
Oh, fantastic. I'll have to. So what drew you to the gumshoe? I call it the gumshoe genre, the private eye, detective, especially in that.
Oh, I've always been a huge fan of, the Chandler, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett. And I just devour all of Sue Grafton's books, the ABCD.
Oh, yeah.
Type of mysteries with Kinsey Millhone. So, yeah, absolutely. And so, when you read those things, you get your own visions, and living in this area, you just get introduced to different characters, different sights and sounds and smells. And the next thing a story starts to form in your brain, and you start throwing it down on the paper.
Yeah, and Southern California is such a good place for it, too.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there's so many characters to draw from. There's so many talented people in this area. Just go around and just listen. I don't like to write at home, alone in the dark. I like to get out and, be at a Starbucks or even out on the pier at Newport Beach out there and just go watch people go by and get my composition book on my lap and start scribbling.
And another great thing about Los Angeles, like New York and Chicago as well, is, you know, the storied history of the place. And I noticed a lot of great characters in your novels that weren't people. I really enjoyed the locations. I know I knew several of those locations. I haven't spent a lot of time down there, but enough. The Alexandra Hotel. And I'm assuming you have some history with some of the places that you chose.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in fact, the Alexandria Hotel, my granddad used to live there.
Oh, really?
You know, so near the downtown. Absolutely. And then, you know, Casey's Irish Cottage is one of my favorite pubs. You go downtown and catch the game. It's one of like, it's like a Cheers in L.A. You actually walk down the stairs to get to it underground.
Everybody, when you walk in, Nick! That's all.
Yeah, they don't call me Nick, but they call me Smalls.
Smalls?
As a kid, yeah.
That's so funny.
I was kind of small when I was a kid.
It's so funny how those things stick with us. And I like how you made that part of the character, too. You know, the whole idea of Whitey, you know, the toe-headed kid. Yeah, because I know right. There are a lot of kids, especially from our generation and the generations before, you know, that were born with what we would maybe call unfortunate names and who were dying to get a nickname. And once they finally got it, they weren't going to let go.
Well, to this day, I haven't discovered the genesis of, you know, how you got from Richard to Dick in the first place. You know?
You got plenty more chances, hopefully, to flesh that out for us.
Yeah. I think I'll make that a part of every part of the book is, you know, his latest theory.
So what were your inspirations for becoming an author? I mean, I'm a huge fan of genres and that, but I've never had the tenacity to sit down and actually write a book. So what was it that that pushed you to finally do that?
I kind of always, you know, written, you know, kept journals. I've tried, you know, since I was a kid, making my own cartoons. And eventually I just write these little short stories, and that's like the original George McFly. You never share them with anybody. You gotta write them. So I've got stacks and stacks of, you know, composition books. And then one time I was went in my office, and one of my coworkers happened to come in while I was at lunch, and I caught her in my office reading through one of my my composition books. And she said, "This is good. Well, you should get this published." They go, "I don't think so." And she goes, "Well, if you don't, I'm going to find an agent for you." So I eventually stepped out and started submitting some of the stuff. I'd written a book called Mr. Breeze. But at the time, I was writing a book called The Migrant. And it got me noticed. And lo and behold, eventually, after several, you know, return messages, kind rejections, and occasionally I get an envelope back with confetti inside that says, "Don't bother us again." You know, someone finally took an interest in me, and off we went.
That's fantastic. You also wrote a few children's books, the KK Mysteries, is that correct?
Yeah, the KK Undercover, absolutely. I started that for my daughter, you know, who was sick with cancer at the time, and we wanted to write a book together, but, you know, she, you know, didn't make it through the experience, but, you know, we got the book published, and so I've written three so far, and Blackstone's really cool about turning them into an audiobook, and I take all those proceeds and donate it to Rady Children's Hospital down in San Diego. And I go around and read at elementary schools and children's hospitals and hand them out to kids. And it's just a cathartic thing for me. You know, it keeps KK alive in my heart, and I get to share, you know, her spirit, which is in those books everywhere I go.
That is fantastic. I got to tell you, I really appreciate your doing this interview with us. It's been a while, like I said, since I read a book that I enjoyed that much.
Oh, I'm really glad. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for writing. I'm glad somebody was able to turn me on to it so soon. I'm usually very slow to pick up on stuff. I'm not. I don't have my finger on the pulse of society, so I rely on those around me to kind of tell me what's good and check it out. And they're usually pretty right. So this one was definitely right on.
Very cool. I'll make sure you get a copy of Fall of Hollywood when it comes out.
Oh, fantastic. I appreciate it. And I will read it and enjoy it. And maybe we'll be able to talk about it afterwards.
Absolutely.
The podcast will still be here. So I would love to have you put out your information. Where can people get information about Nick Stanton and his books?
Sure. I've got a blog I run. It's at www.authorhood.blogspot.com. And you can see all, you know, of my books on there, and also view some of the trailers that I've done, and help me critique the new books out of Hollywood as I write it. You can get it in real time.
That is amazing.
The books are available, of course, on Downpour and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, etc. I have a blog that I write. It's at www.authorhood.blogspot.com. gumshoediaries.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Nick Stanton, author of The Gumshoe Diaries, the first book, Fortune Cookies Always Lie, with a sequel coming out soon, Father Hollyweird. It has been a pleasure having you on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
All right, thanks very much, Jerry.
Thank you,
Nick. Have a great day.
You too.
To learn more about Nicholas Stanton, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
I don't really remember feeling like this.
Rapper Thrax Up continuously performs and releases hits. His rap career looks to take flight. He talks about it in this interview with president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. You know, today we are, like, you know, really honored to have on Thrax Up. He's just a fantastic rapper, you know, and it's such an honor to have you on our show again. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me back. It's an honor to be on your show.
Hey, yeah. How's your day going out there, man?
Oh, yeah, man. Just chilling. <laughs> Hard day. It's kind of hot out here, too. I'm in the AC watching Sports Center. I'm playing some NFL tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, tell me, man. You know, you've got a lot of new things going on, and all of our listening audiences is dying to hear about it. So let's get right into it.
Yeah, well, I just dropped some new songs. I got some songs on iHeartRadio and Spotify and Tidal and all that streaming service BS that they have over the internet nowadays. But you can follow me there at Thrax Up. I got three singles out right now. I'm working on dropping the first CD. The first CD is called Bill. I got a lot of stuff coming. It's such an honor. That's why I wanted to come back and do a follow up with you, because we are. I did Just Another Day. Just Another Day has finally been. I got all my music and everything copyrighted with like a legally branded team now. So I went out, and Just Another Day is my single off of the Bill CD coming out soon. But I just went along and just. To, you know, drop the Just Another Day, and then right after Just Another Day, I dropped Comprehend and Thinking to Myself. These are my two latest songs that I just put out, and they've been going fire on Spotify. A lot of people saying they like it, so I'm just trying to build the anticipation for the mixtape. This is my first CD since we first talked. I still haven't dropped that CD since we first talked back last year, so. Hopefully the anticipation is even better now.
Like with a lot of talented artists like yourself, you know, I mean, people think that, you know, these creations, you know, and Just Another Day, as a matter of fact, I've seen the video and I've heard the song and it's fantastic. But people think that, you know, it's like, you know, like Picasso painted this painting, you know, he did it, you know, in his spare time one night, you know, these things take a long time to develop, you know?
Yeah. Like, that's what I keep trying to tell everybody. That's why my title is Benjamin's Influence, Life Longevity. Because when I go into the studio, I don't go and try to make, you know, just a summertime hit or a romance hit just for this time. No, I'm thinking like 6 months from now to like 2 years from now, if my songs can still be played, you know, it's like having that, it's like producing the classics. Like, that's why everybody keeps asking me why I wait so long to push out my first CD, but it's all because, you know, I don't want to push out any BS and have people disappointed, and that's just me wasting my time, you know. And since then, like, I've been doing shows. I did, like, in the last 3 months, I did about 65 shows.
Wow. Now, yeah. I'm going to ask you the common question is that, you know, do you enjoy studio time more, or do you like getting out and mixing it up with the people?
I'm a more of a sociable person, you know, like, I'm not going to lie, when I'm in the studio, that's when, like, I'm at my most serious. Like, I don't really joke around or try to be, like, off topic too much, because, you know, that's, like, my working area. and that's where I go to make my living. But like when I'm out at shows and meeting new fans, or when I go to other people's shows to like meet and network, I love being sociable. Like everybody will tell you like I'm the most coolest mellow guy you'll probably know. Like I just love to, you know, be peaceful, you know? You gotta spread the mellow, especially in this generation.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you 100% on that, you know, and it's great the way you're, you know, that you're going about it. Just, you know, for all of our listening audience around the world here, you know, let's hear a little bit of Just Another Day.
Yeah, it was just another day. Problems sticking like resin, causing congestion from past to present. Can't appreciate the damn progression, and life's a lesson. Trying to break records I'm never seeing second, but I take it for granted. I swear this cash I demand it. Full respect, a backhand, I leave your crash landing. Understand me, it's all up in my day's work. Murder all she wrote, jotting words down just to requote. And it's a joke, bright lights and make.
Look at man, that was amazing, you know, and it's easy to see that you are, you know, you're a rising star in this industry, and you know that's got to be a satisfying feeling for you.
Oh yes, and it's the fact of the matter that I'm doing this all by myself. Like I book my own shows, I write my own stuff, I go out, I contact companies, get my own interviews, get my own endorsements, stuff like that. Like I handle my own business, and people think that like this is like easy, and everybody asking like, oh man, you know, Spotify and iHeartRadio, why aren't you famous yet? I'm like, man, I just don't know. I'm like, I don't know yet. I just got to keep putting in the groundwork. You know, like the groundwork was me getting everything copyrighted and legal. And then now the next right was me getting everything just out there so people can hear, like millions of people. I have people in, like a friend in Norway. He like screenshots me when it plays on his Spotify account. Like it's crazy, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what I keep. That's why I want to keep happening.
Well, you know, I was gonna say, you know, I kind of disagree with you that you know that you're not getting famous, because you are famous, and you know, just you know, look, you know, we have a following of over 90,000 people a week that download our show around the world. You know, and you know, and here you are on, you know, and that's because, you know, there's a demand out there. People want to hear your music. They want to, you know, they want to hear the, you know, the person behind the, you know, the music, and, you know, feel like they're part of the scene, you know. And give me an example.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys too. We appreciate every listener and every fan and supporter.
Yeah, you know, I give you a quick example. You know, like right now, Amy Schumer is a comedian, and she's just like blowing up all over the place, you know, with you know, her movie Trainwreck and things like that. And everybody thinks that, you know, like, wow, Amy Schumer, man, this is a year of her, you know, and she's like overnight sensation. But, you know, she was a stand-up comedian for 10 years and nobody knew who she was.
You know? Yep. That's how it usually goes, you know, diamond in the dirt. And when you do get found, everybody appreciates you.
Yeah, you know, and we certainly appreciate you, that's for sure. So are you
I appreciate you too.
But let me ask you this question here, Thrasup. You know, are you still having fun doing this, man? Because it looks like every time I see a picture of you, man, I was like, this dude is having the time of his life.
Yes, I love it. Like that's the main part of all about it. Like I love what I want to do. I love what I do. Music is like my life, my bloodline. It ain't like a hobby; it's a career. You know, it's something I can see myself doing 10 to 15 years later and still producing at a high quality. I just love being around music. I've been producing other people's songs, helping other artists with gaining services, you know, like spreading it out, like trying to help out everyone. That's why I keep trying to tell everyone that we all help each other, and there's no way for failure.
Yeah, you know, and your formula for success is obviously working. You know, we're talking to you. People from around the world are talking to you. Everyone's, you know, downloading your music. And it, you know, the thing is that, and I've told people this before, too. It's just like when they hear somebody that's really successful, they go like, wow, you know, what kind of marketing strategy do you use? This and that. And I would always tell them, and I've said this to our cast on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Oh, I said, yeah, this dude was a success, you know, but you're missing the big point. The big point is, you know, he writes good music, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a saying in the theater, and the theater is that you know, like people that do plays, like Shakespeare plays and whatnot, or even movies or whatever, or concerts.
Yeah.
You can promote something. You know, you can promote the, you know, the hell out of it. You know, and the saying goes like this: I can get you 10,000 people, you know, to come to your opening night, right? Through promotion.
Yeah.
But you got to bring them back. Yeah.
Exactly. You got to apply yourself.
Oh, we love it. We love it. You know, anytime, you know, that we have a chance to reach out to you, you know, we are there. I'll share with you something that happened to me a few years back. We did a show, and we've done quite a few shows now with Bobby Seale, the founder of the Black Panthers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have him on like every February for Black History Month. And so, you know, the first time he was on, man, we had him on, you know, and he's a really cool dude, by the way. So we had him on, right? And I was in the grocery store, dude. And, you know, because our logo has our picture on it, I'm in the grocery store, and there's this guy standing behind me, and he's looking at me, right? And then I don't know who he is, and I'm like, you know, why is this guy staring at me, you know? Then the guy goes to me, he goes, hey, he goes, I really love that Bobby Seale interview, man. And I go like, oh, cool, thanks.
Awkward moment for a little second.
Yeah.
But it's a great feeling, though.
And you got to get used to that, man, because that's going to be happening to you. You're so young, you know, and it's going to be happening to you. You're going to blow up, man. And, you know, we just hope that when you get, you know, like, you know, super famous, man, that you'll still come on and talk with us.
Hell yeah. You got to. I got to keep rocking with the day one people. You guys are like helping me like reach new fan bases, and I appreciate that. I appreciate you guys just having me on here just to talk.
Well, you know what? We really, really, like I said, I've said it before, you know, we really dig your music, and we, you know, we love talking with you, and we love what you're producing, and the way you're going about it is even, you know, more miraculous. Now, let's tell everybody again, you know, the name of the album is going to be
Bill, which is Benjamin and Lawrence White Longevity.
Love it, man. I love it. Oh, that's right.
If you go on my Facebook, you can see the preview for the cover art. I have the cover art as my cover picture.
Nice.
On my Facebook page.
We'll be sure to include that, man, on the Just Imagine Inc. website, so people can click onto it and go right to your Facebook page and you know, and like you and follow you, and you know, it's just great, man. You know what? I'm sure you can hear it in my voice, man. I'm just really excited to talk to you, and I'm so glad, you know, that you came back on. And thank you very much, Rex Up.
Feelings is mutual. I'm stoked that you all had me. I appreciate everything.
To learn more about Thrax Up, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
The Revenant, an unforgettable novel of revenge, and now a major motion picture starring Leonardo DiCaprio with 12 Oscar nominations. The year is 1823, and the trappers of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company live a brutal frontier life. Trapping beaver, they contend daily with the threat of Indian tribes turned warlike over the white men's encroachment on their land and other prairie foes, like the unforgiving landscape and its creatures. Hugh Glass is among the company's finest men, an experienced frontiersman and an expert tracker, but when a scouting mission puts him face to face with a grizzly bear, he is viciously mauled and not expected to survive. The company's captain dispatches two of his men to stay behind and tend to Glass before he dies and to give him the respect of a proper burial. When the two men abandon him instead, taking his only means of protecting himself, including his precious gun and hatchet, with them, Glass is driven to survive by one desire, revenge. With shocking grit and determination, Glass sets out crawling inch by inch across more than 3,000 miles of uncharted American frontier, negotiating predators both human and not, the threat of starvation and the agony of his horrific wounds. In Michael Punk's hauntingly spare and gripping prose, The Revenant is a remarkable tale of obsession, the human will stretched to its limits, and the lengths that one man will go for retribution.
Hugh Glass stared down at the cloven tracks, the deep indentations clear as newsprint in the soft mud. Two distinct sets began at the river's edge, where the deer must have drunk, and then trailed into the heavy cover of the willows. The persistent work of a beaver had carved a trail, now trod by a variety of game. Dung lay piled next to the tracks, and Glass stooped to touch the pea-sized pellets. Still warm. Glass looked west, where the sun still perched high above the plateau that formed the distant horizon. He guessed there were 3 hours before sunset. Still early, but it would take the captain and the rest of the men an hour to catch up. Besides, it was an ideal campsite. The river folded gently against a long bar and gravel bank. Beyond the willows, a stand of cottonwoods offered cover for their campfires and a supply of firewood. The willows were ideal for smoke racks. Glass noticed plum trees scattered among the willows. A lucky break. They could grind pemmican from the combined fruit and meat. He looked downriver. Where's Black Harris? In the hierarchy of challenges the trappers faced each day, obtaining food was the most immediate. Like other challenges, it involved a complicated balancing of benefits and risks. They carried virtually no food with them, especially since abandoning the flatboats on the Missouri and proceeding on foot up the Grand. A few men still had tea or sugar, but most were down to a bag of salt for preserving meat. Game was plentiful on this stretch of the Grand, and they could have dined on fresh meat each night, but harvesting game meant shooting, and the sound of a rifle carried from miles, revealing their position to any foe within earshot. Since leaving the Missouri, the men had held closely to a pattern. Each day, two scouted ahead of the others. For the time being, their path was fixed. They simply followed the Grand. The scouts' primary responsibilities were to avoid Indians, select a campsite, and find food. They shot fresh game every few days. After shooting a deer or buffalo calf, the scouts prepared the camp for the evening. They bled the game, gathered wood, and set two or three small fires in narrow rectangular pits.
Michael Punk serves as the United States Ambassador to the World Trade Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. He has also served on the White House National Security Council staff and on Capitol Hill. He was formerly the history correspondent for Montana Quarterly and an adjunct professor at the University of Montana. He is the author of Fire and Brimstone, The North Butte Mine Disaster of 1917, and Last Stand, George Bird Grinnell, The Battle to Save the Buffalo, and The Birth of the New West. His family home is in Montana. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
For those of you that have come and seen me over so many years, it's been a fantastic ride. Thank you very much. For those of you that have maybe just found my music, I don't know where I'm going from here, but I promise I won't bore you. Okay. Do a couple more songs. Then it'll be au revoir. Got a song about him.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Carson Bench.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
Television and this crisis, same with juvenile delinquent rights. Oh man, I don't need TV, but I got T-Rex. Probably too good, but I'm a dude.
Now the young dude.
Oh, the young dude.
Carry the news.
Carry the news.
Carry the news.
Oh.
a mule, it's a real mean scheme. We can love.
Yeah, we can love.